You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, President Trump is making changes to another major environmental law, saying it will speed up infrastructure projects. We'll talk to a Wisconsin law professor about what's changing and what it means for roads, pipelines, and pollution. Now, Congress returns to session this week as the federal unemployment enhancer payments are about to expire. The $600 payouts were part of the coronavirus relief package known as the CARES Act that was passed in late March. The idea was to prop up household income for the millions of Americans who lost their jobs. That unemployment provision ends over the next week, and Republicans and Democrats are at odds on what to do about it. Senate Majority Leader Republican Mitch McConnell recently said just extending the plan as is isn't going to fly.
Unemployment is extremely important, and we need to make sure for those who are not able to recover their jobs, unemployment is adequate. That is a different issue from whether we ought to pay people a bonus not to go back to work. So I think that was a mistake. And we're hearing it all over the country that it's made it harder, actually, to get people back to work. But to have the basic protections of unemployment insurance is extremely important and should be continued.
Democrats say the extra payments are needed because many workplaces aren't safe enough yet for people to go back to work. Stephen Smith is a distinguished professor of social sciences and professor of political science at Washington University in St. Louis. Steve, welcome back to the show.
Thanks. Great to be here.
There's a lot of different items on the table in the potential next round of coronavirus economic relief spending. How far apart are Republicans and Democrats on this particular one, this enhanced unemployment payment?
Well, they couldn't be farther apart. The House wants to extend the payment, $1,200 payments, and even up the ante a little bit by providing more support for children, and extend it through January. So essentially another 6 months. It runs out on July 31. The Republicans, as you just heard, are, I think they're up for some extension, but they want to reduce the size of the payments and perhaps condition them on other factors, perhaps your previous income, perhaps the state of the economy or the health crisis in your state. All of those proposals seem to have been offered by Republicans in the last 3 or 4 weeks.
The clock is ticking here. It seems like a tall order to get any kind of agreement on this to kick in before the current one disappears. Can Congress work fast enough if they end up agreeing that they want to do some kind of extension, even partial?
Well, the unemployment extension is largely a matter of the federal government providing the additional support to the state. So in principle, that can happen very quickly. But of course, it's caught up in a debate over a much, much larger set of issues, including the IRS payment program, where people just got a check from the IRS, payments to state and local governments. We're hearing now that the Republicans want to condition more money on the schools, for the schools, on them reopening. So there are literally dozens of differences between the two parties, and the unemployment benefits are caught up in all of that.
Now, we heard Speaker McConnell saying the payments are, in some places, in some cases, a disincentive to work. He says employers are saying, hey, we can't get people to come back to work because they're making more on unemployment. Is that a fair criticism of what Congress had passed earlier?
Well, it appears to be founded in some real evidence that a very large percentage of the recipients of the unemployment benefits actually did end up getting more money with the $600 additional from the federal government. Remember, that's on top of whatever state unemployment benefits you receive. Mm-hmm. So if in a state like Wisconsin, where the benefits are, you know, in the neighborhood of, oh, maybe $350 per week, the $600 on top of that is a substantial increase in the unemployment benefits. And there are many, especially service workers, minimum wage workers who are not earning that much money. The Republicans argue that this is a disincentive for people to return to work. The Democrats are arguing that there's very little disincentive because there are very few jobs available at the current time. The Democrats add the additional argument, which I think is right, that Unemployment benefits get spent, so they stimulate the economy. Someone who's unemployed and gets that $600 a week is very likely to spend it right away, and so the local economy at least benefits almost immediately. So this really is a question of the Republicans are not denying, by the way, that the economy needs an additional stimulus. They seem to be arguing for a payroll tax cut, tax credits for opening up businesses. The White House has talked about tax deductions for dining and entertainment expenses. So there seems to be an agreement that an additional economic stimulus is required, but there's a big difference between the parties about who ought to get the money in order to create the stimulus.
We're talking to political scientist Stephen Smith at Washington University, looking at congressional efforts at economic recovery spending, especially the idea of expending some or all of additional unemployment payments. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you been depending on those extra payments? What has it meant for you if you're unemployed? In general, do you think this is a good idea that should continue as the coronavirus crisis goes on? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. I want to give a listen to House Speaker Nancy Pelosi, a Democrat, talking about the notion that the enhancer is motivating recipients to not work. Here's a listen.
People do not want to risk their lives and that of their families by going to work that isn't safe. We can open the economy if we make it safe for people to go back to work. Are they going to pay people to risk their lives without any OSHA standard and the rest? People are not staying home. They want to work. They want to go to work in a safe place.
And Steve, that's another wrinkle on the conversation we're having. You know, do we want to get people back into work or incentivize people to go to restaurants and elsewhere if we're not through the worst of the COVID-19 outbreak?
Well, that's right. The two parties seem to be going in opposite directions on this question. The Republicans eager to open up the economy and do what they can to encourage businesses to reopen and bring workers back. And the Democrats saying, no, we've got to kill this pandemic first, and then the economy will come back. So let's focus on keeping people's heads above water and dealing more directly with the healthcare crisis. So there is a difference in big differences in their judgment about what is appropriate action at this point.
I want to touch on some of the other issues on the table. You mentioned that idea of a payroll tax cut, and I've seen it presented in some cases as possibly not a payroll tax cut, but a deferment potentially that workers
right.
who pay those payroll taxes would just have to pay maybe in a year or something like that. How would this work? How would this help or hurt?
Well, the payroll tax cut, remember, is the tax that supports Medicare and Social Security. So any permanent or long-lasting reduction in the tax will obviously cause financial problems for those two programs if it's actually not corrected in some fashion. So the idea of a deferral is to say that people, the tax is now shared between an employer and an employee. So reducing the tax will save them both money in the short run. To make it a deferral would mean that, at least according to the law that they are proposing now, is that they'd have to pay it later, just not now. Well, that would mean that people would get socked harder at some later point, say in a year, once we're past the crisis. And it's assumed that Congress wouldn't allow that to happen. And so between now and then, they would actually pass additional legislation to basically waive those back taxes. So why play that kind of a game? Well, it's mainly to reduce the cost of the current program, at least on paper. If you're merely deferring, you're assuming you're going to get that revenue sometime in the near future. But it's an accounting game.
We're talking about the federal supplemental unemployment benefits set to expire soon with Stephen Smith and other elements in the potential for a new economic recovery program in Congress. Steve is a distinguished professor of social sciences and professor of political science at Washington University in St. Louis. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you want to see Congress extend this $600 weekly program, this enhanced unemployment payment? Is it enough? Is it too much? Should it go away? Should it be restricted to fewer people? Have you been depending on this? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're talking about the federal enhanced unemployment benefits due to expire at the end of the month and what Congress may or may not do about them. Stephen Smith is with us, distinguished professor of social sciences and professor of political science at Washington University in St. Louis. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think? Should these be extended? Have you been relying on these payments? Are they too much? Do you worry that they're keeping people from going back to work even when they can? Call 800-642-1234. We'll go to your calls now. David is with us in Richland. David, hi.
Hi. Yeah, my wife was off for a couple of weeks, and she got the bonus $600, and she ended up making more money than she did on her regular job. I think it's a problem to have this bonus going out to people, because where is that money coming from? Your speaker talked about, yeah, it's stimulating the economy because people are spending it, but where does that money come from? It's got to come from somewhere. It's just not magical, and we don't just print it off as we need it. I think it needs to go away. I think it was a mistake to start with.
Steve, thanks a lot for the call. A concern about the deficit impact of this, Steve.
Well, it's a serious concern, of course. The money is largely being borrowed. It's being borrowed like much of the money for the tax cut at the beginning of the Trump administration. It's largely being borrowed like the $3 trillion we've already spent on the stimulus packages. And now the question is whether or not, in the long run, an investment in recovery now will make us better off than just holding pat. And so this is a question of really how the money is spent, because certainly there are good things to spend the money on. If we end up having more people sick, if we end up creating violence in the streets, if there's more social unrest, if people are not getting educated because of the combination of a health and economic crisis, then borrowing in order to avoid those harms might make sense. And so this is this is what budgeting is all about, is how you make your investments. And so far, most economists have made the case that these large multi-trillion-dollar investments are essential to keeping the economy afloat.
David, thanks for calling in. We'll go to Diane now with us in Stoddard. Diane, hi.
Well, thanks for taking my call. I'm kind of on a non-receiving end. I stay at home, and my husband had his own business. Well, his business basically has dried up and failed. He was an independent contractor. He has been forced to take, I guess, a $15 an hour job, which then, since we're not getting any money from, well, we did get the stimulus package for him and I, which just paid for 1 month of medical insurance for us. But since he changed the job, we were able to chop down our medical expenses quite a bit. But still, we have nothing coming in. It's very stressful. What about independent contractors?
Diane, thanks a lot for that call. And I understand, Steve, that and good luck to you, by the way, Diane and your husband, that had been a change in the package, that unemployment was going to cover more people than it usually did, I thought, including independent contractors.
Precisely. That is in the House passed bill, the so-called HEROES Act, that was passed in May. And the Senate hasn't acted on that yet. And that's what's coming to a head this week. So, yes, the House Democrats anticipated, were well aware of that problem. And so independent contractors and a few others who were not previously eligible for unemployment benefits would be eligible for this $600 payment.
Diane, thanks. Good luck to you and your husband again. And I think maybe call the state unemployment system. There might, no promises here, but it's probably worth investigating, I think. Steve, just in our last minute and a half or so, I want to touch on one other point of controversy and another potential package, the idea of aid for state and local governments. What's the current state of argument there?
Well, the $3 trillion proposal that the House Democrats put on the table includes $1 trillion, or a third of it, for state and local governments and schools. The White House and the Senate Republicans are currently talking about providing no state and local funding, maybe maintaining some school funding, but making that contingent on the schools reopening. There was also an important, for us in the upper Midwest, important additional funding for tribal governments, and the Republicans are wrapping that up with their proposal to cut state, local, and tribal funding out of the House proposal. So a huge difference between the two parties on that question.
And briefly, as we wrap up, what's the key point you're watching for in the next week or so?
Well, it really is a question of where the Senate Republicans choose to go. They're getting pushed from the right pretty hard from the White House. Obviously, there's a Democratic proposal from the House on the table. The next thing to look for is what comes out of a luncheon meeting of Senate Republicans tomorrow at noon.
Steve, thanks as always for joining us today.
My pleasure.
Stephen Smith is a distinguished professor of social sciences and a professor of political science at Washington University in St. Louis. We talked to him today about the politics of extending the federal unemployment insurance benefits set to expire over the next week. Right now, it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a story about a Wisconsin musician whose fan base has grown globally.
Rapper and songwriter Ted Park grew up in Madison and got his start recording songs on his dad's laptop in South Korea. Now, the 25-year-old is living in New York City and has tens of thousands of fans around the world. WPR's Eric Lorenzen recently talked with Park about his Wisconsin roots and his journey to the bigger stages.
Hip-hop is just so emotional. The hunger, the story, the power. If I were to record myself saying something and, like, saying my message, like, that's how I wanted to do it. My name's Ted Park. I'm 25 years old, and I'm from Madison, Wisconsin. I make music. DJ Payne 1. Yeah, I've been lit, acting a fool. That's a bad bit. Need about two. I want a Rari. Let it go zoom. Drop on the top. Hound in the coupe. Yeah, I've been lit. No need to... I feel like I got a little bit of something for everyone. You know, I got ballads. Girl, you used to call me when I used to be your man. I wanted to say sorry. I got more turn-up stuff if you're trying to have fun. I put in my ears, I got so much to prove. From Wisconsin, now my pockets got that big cheese. Pull up in that six speed. She like that I'm risky. No friend of mine. But I think the most important thing is that I have my own flavor, my own sound. I have my own voice. And it's very authentic and honest to me. Now, I never changed my number, hit my phone. Now, hello, I don't know who is this. Hello, I don't know who is this. Hey, it's been a minute, how you doing? Hey, it's been a minute, how you doing? What you on? I just flew into the county, promised I'd come back around. That's just me saying, like, no matter where I am in life, you know, how far I go, like, I'll always have Madison in my heart. Growing up in Madison, like, it was very calm for me. Played a lot of sports, studied a lot, read a lot of books. And then I feel like when I went to Korea, like, my whole life just like flipped. 13 years old, man. Like, I'm leaving my friends behind, my life behind. And I was not really proud to be Asian at that time. Imagining myself like living in Korea with a bunch of other Korean people, like, I hated that, man. I started just trying to rap. I was like, just like going through like my parents' stuff, and I found a little webcam microphone and I plugged it in to my dad's laptop, and I downloaded the Swagger Like Us instrumental. That was the first beat I rapped on. You know, for me to go to Korea, for my life to like totally disintegrate, I wouldn't have discovered music. I got to get in touch with my roots. I actually became kind of proud to be an Asian person. I come back to Madison for high school. I was like, I'm gonna be a rapper. Everyone was like, nah. I was like, you know what? I'm staying committed regardless of what anyone says. And I'm gonna stunt on these haters later, you know. I dropped out and I went to New York City. Hello, I don't know who is this. Hello, I don't know. 2016, it's 4 years ago. me and my big brother DJ Payne One put out Hello Who Is This. We definitely never knew that was gonna be like my launching song. We go viral on Spotify. Pretty much every record label hits me up. And I think that was the first time seeing some sort of independent success. I just kept putting music out. Just did a North American tour. LA headline show 3 weeks ago. It's been crazy. I'll say I'm from Wisconsin. And people be like, oh man, cows, cheese, Milwaukee Bucks, Packers. I'm like, yeah. When I hear Wisconsin, I think Blue Mendota, I think family, and I think peace of mind. It used to be love-hate, because I was like, how come my city won't fully get behind me? My career blossomed outside of Madison, but my relationship with Madison doesn't have to be music and business, because it's home, and I'm proud of where I'm from. I'm proud of being that small-town kid, this Asian-American kid from Madison, Wisconsin, that is somehow blowing up right now. I don't say no numbers.
That was rapper and songwriter Ted Park, who grew up in Madison and now has fans around the world. He's been releasing a new song every Tuesday, which you can find on his Instagram. WPR's Eric Lawrenson talked with him earlier this year. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. I'm Maureen McCollum.
Coming up, we'll find out what changes the Trump administration is making to a 50-year-old package of environmental laws. They say the president says it'll boost infrastructure creation, highways, pipelines, and more. Conservationists worry about the impacts on pollution and especially at-risk communities. You can weigh in with your thoughts over at the Ideas Network Facebook page. Do you agree with the decision? Do you worry about the impacts? Maybe a little of both. Again, weigh in over at the Ideas Network Facebook page. Stick around. There's more to come. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network. Listening to Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up tomorrow at 7 on The Morning Show, Wisconsin is seeing a lot of ads already in the presidential race, and there's more to come. Kate Archer-Kent and her guests look at the political advertising race here in Wisconsin and around the country. That's tomorrow morning at 7 here on the Ideas Network. Now, President Trump announced changes last week to the National Environmental Policy Act, a landmark package of laws that first took effect in 1970 under then-President Republican Richard Nixon. President Trump said the regulatory changes would help create more infrastructure projects. They involve speeding up the environmental reviews that federally funded projects go through and not requiring regulators to look at the cumulative effect of a project on the environment and climate. Construction and business groups cheered the move. Many conservationists say it amounts to a giveaway to polluters and gives people affected by big projects less of a chance to push back. Steph Tye is a professor of law at the University of Wisconsin-Madison Law School, focusing on environmental law. Steph, welcome back to Central Time.
Hi, thanks for having me here.
Well, first, can you talk about the National Environmental Policy Act generally and what it does?
Yeah, it was a federal law, as you mentioned, signed by Richard Nixon in 1970. And it's a law that requires all federal agencies to evaluate the environmental effects of their actions. And the language of the statute is it requires an environmental impact statement for federal actions leading to major changes or major major federal actions significantly affecting the environment. And so what that has ended up meaning is that federal agencies have had since then to do some kind of environmental analysis before engaging in any kind of project, such as an infrastructure project that you mentioned before, but also in many other areas, for instance, grant funding, permit giving, those are all included as federal actions. And so it's had a pretty wide-ranging effect in terms of creating this sort of pre-decisional analysis requirement for federal agencies.
Now, this is a law passed by Congress, signed by a president. How much leeway does a sitting president have to change the way it works on his or her own?
Well, this is interesting. So the statutory language has not changed, and so that will still be the hardcore kind of requirements. However, different administrations can pass what are called regulations implementing how they will apply the statute. And so what this administration has done through the agency called the Council for Environmental Quality, which is the agency that is charged under NEPA with administrating NEPA, they've issued these new sort of regulations interpreting NEPA. This has been a pretty substantial change because the first regulations issued by the CEQ were in 1978. There haven't been any major substantial changes like this until now. And so there's one, yes, there is an opportunity for this administration to change the interpretation of NEPA, but one, they are still bound to the underlying text of NEPA, which means that if litigants are able to assert that these current proposed changes actually conflict with the underlying statutory basis, they can be challenged. But if not, then yes, they can sort of change how this agency will sort of end up applying the National Environmental Policy Act.
Talking to UW-Madison law professor Steph Tighe about changes to a key environmental protection law coming from the Trump administration. You can join in with your reactions, your thoughts, and your questions at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. A big point the president has made and supporters of this decision have made is that, hey, the length of the current review process is really long. Here's a listen to what the president had to say.
So we're cutting the federal permitting timeline for a major project from up to 20 years or more, hard to believe, down to 2 years or less. So we have it down to about 2 years right now, Elaine, and I think 2 years or less. And our goal is 1 year.
So let's talk about what the president and others are calling a lengthy process under the current system. I think 20 years is not really the norm, but people say it can go many years, much more than 2 years.
Yes. So, yes, indeed. The process has been quite lengthy for certain types of projects. But part of the reason why it's been so lengthy is that they still have to meet the substantive requirements of the National Environmental Policy Act. And this is to get back to what I was saying earlier. Yes, a particular administration can say under the proposed regulations that agencies are only to take up to 1 year or up to 2 years without, you know, with perhaps some exceptions by senior administrators. And that's what this administration has done. But nevertheless, the agency still has to comply with the substantive statutory requirements of the National Environmental Policy Act, which is to evaluate all of these changes before engaging in the project. And so if they do this sort of minimal 2-year review, and really what it takes is actually, you know, 6 years of analysis or something, a court will still find that the agency has managed to violate the substantive statutory requirements of the National Environmental Policy Act, even if it manages to comply with the regulations that were issued under this administration. So, yes, it might shorten it in a short run, but because of possible actual challenges arising under the statute, it still might be a lengthy kind of process.
That's the clock on the review process. There's another change here, and that is the idea that these regulators shouldn't consider cumulative impacts of pollution, whether that's another pollution-emitting factory, say, in an area already hard hit by pollution, or downstream effects, say, on climate change. Can you talk about how this change might work?
Yeah, so I think the rationale behind this regulatory change is to allow agencies to consider a narrower set of effects, right, created by a project. And by considering a narrower set of effects, one, an agency might determine that the action doesn't, you know, significantly affect the human environment and therefore would do a sort of smaller analysis known as the environmental assessment, or they would have to do less in the final EIS. That said, right, there still is, as I mentioned, the underlying substantive requirements of the National Environmental Policy Act itself versus the regulations. And what that means is that it's possible that an agency might not analyze what's called the cumulative effects because the regulations don't require it, but a court could still find that the agency failed to actually fulfill the requirements in the statute itself. So that's one of the other tricky things here. There's the regulations, which directs an agency to do something, but there still is that statutory language, which has not been changed by Congress at all.
We're talking to Steph Tai, professor of law at the UW-Madison Law School, looking at changes the president is making to the National Environmental Policy Act. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think of the changes to environmental law, this one and others that have been made by the Trump administration so far? Do you think the approval process for things like pipelines or highways or other projects should be sped up? Are you worried that this could ultimately lead to less oversight of pollution? How do you think we can strike a balance between the environment and infrastructure programs? Do you have questions about how this all works? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk with UW-Madison law professor Steph Tai, looking at changes to the National Environmental Policy Act that the president announced last week. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a question about these changes, the impact they might or might not have? Do you agree with the president's efforts, he says, to speed up approval of various kinds of infrastructure projects by shortening the potential review period? Do you have concerns or do you approve of the president's overall approach when it comes to environmental regulations during his term? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Steph, if I'm hearing you right on the key changes in this provision from the White House, in a process level, they're going to look different. You think at a fundamental level, if and when they hit the courts, it may not make that much difference as to which projects get approved or not. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, I think that's fair to say. I mean, it might, depending on the way that the judiciary sort of interprets the actions of this administration. And as we know, this administration has also appointed a number of judges, which might be more sympathetic to this administration's view of what types of analysis are to be required under there. But most people think that, one, there still is going to be available substantive challenges under the National Environmental Policy Act. And two, this is driven a little bit first in order to demonstrate some kind of sympathy towards the sort of contractors who will be engaging in these infrastructure projects, and also perhaps to sort of put in some kind of framing that limits evaluation of long-term climate change effects. Because one of the things that's discussed most in their reduction of or removal of cumulative impacts analysis is the suggestion that's brought in there that it shouldn't be analyzed with a number of different other projects. And most observers think that's related to more power kind of projects and pipeline projects.
Well, and I don't think climate change was first and foremost on the mind of lawmakers in 1970. So is that something that might pass muster in the courts, saying, don't consider this thing that wasn't, I imagine, specifically enumerated in the law?
It could be. I mean, again, there's many different types of interpretive techniques for statutes, and a more textual kind of interpretation would be, and we saw that actually in the Bostock case, this term from the Supreme Court, which involved the interpretation of sex under the Civil Rights Act. A textualist interpretation might say, you know, it doesn't matter what was in the mind of Congress at the time. What matters is the actual language of the statute. And if it substantively affects things, it doesn't matter if it substantively affects because it adds to climate change or doesn't. If it substantively affects things, then it does. It's still included, even if the drafters of the National Environmental Policy Act didn't contemplate this specific kind of thing. So again, it'll depend a lot on the philosophy of statutory interpretation that's applied by judges.
Talking to UW-Madison law professor Steph Tai about a couple of changes to a key environmental law, the process for enforcing that law made by the Trump administration. Steph, let's look at this now as part of the whole. What can you talk about the direction we've seen from the Trump administration when it comes to executive orders, regulatory changes like this one, when it comes to environmental enforcement?
Well, it's interesting on two different types of levels. One, the administration has shown a clear devotion to trying to sort of streamline allowing federal projects to proceed if they're federal projects involving infrastructure, power plant approval, pipeline approval, all of these sort of approvals that many environmentalists are more skeptical about. However, at the same time, these executive orders have been challenged in court as being insufficiently based upon some kind of rational basis. And so many of these changes have been, many of these proposed changes or even their final changes have been held up in court for a while. And it is possible that this will happen here with this sort of final regulation put out by the CEQ. There's a number of groups that have been talked about as probably raising various challenges. And so that will also come into play as, you know, as we see this administration proceed. There's a chance that it'll get overturned. And so this might not matter in the first place. I don't know exactly how that'll go.
Let's bring on a caller now. Charles is with us in Eau Claire. Charles, hi.
Hi. I was wondering, it seems like the overall goal of these changes is to accelerate these infrastructure programs. Is there any other way to do that without changing these environmental regulations?
Charles, thanks for the call. Sorry, go ahead, Steph.
Oh, sorry about that. I mean, you know, if Congress actually wanted to specifically exempt any kind of specific infrastructure project from that, Congress could do that itself, right? They could basically create a statutory exemption for a particular project for NEPA, and that would allow the project to proceed. So if there was both White House commitment and congressional commitment to that, something like that, that could very well streamline the project. There are other ways to sort of streamline projects by, you know, actually engaging in projects that don't have these kind of environmental impacts. That is, if a project adds on mitigation measures such that the level of that project's environmental impacts don't actually significantly affect the environment, then they won't have to go through the much lengthier environmental impact statement analysis kind of process. So one, streamline, yes, Congress could just streamline it. Two, they could just go up at the very beginning and engage in environmental mitigation measures such that the project doesn't have much of an effect either.
Charles, thanks a lot for that call. Steph, looking ahead, if President Trump wins re-election, this kind of regulatory change presumably would stay in effect. If another president were to take office, would they have the same latitude to switch back to the way things were before this announcement?
Absolutely. They can, another administration can go through and issue a new CEQ reg. They'd have to go through the same process, do a draft regulation, allow for public notice and comment, and then issue a final regulation. But a final, a new administration could change this proposal. The other thing too is actually if the Democrats keep the House and attain Senate, they could use what's called the Congressional Review Act to also rescind these sort of late term kind of regulatory approaches. That's what happened at the beginning of the Trump administration when the House and Senate used the Congressional Review Act to rescind a number of late sort of term Obama administration regulations. So that's also a possibility as well, depending on the numbers.
In our last minute or so, Steph, do you think this is going to be hashed out in courts before Election Day, or is this process going to take long enough that we'll still be figuring out what's going to happen after we all go to vote in November?
I suspect that it'll be after we vote in November. It's going to be courts are already pretty backlogged with the number of challenges to other sort of Trump administration actions. And so that'll sort of tie things up in courts for a while. So I doubt that it will get to any sort of final decision until well after the election. There might be some kind of district court decision that arises if someone finds a hook enough to bring it to district court, but likely it won't be until after the election that we'll hear anything from courts.
Steph, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Yeah, thank you.
Steph Tighe is a professor of law at the UW-Madison Law School. We've been talking about changes the Trump administration is making to a key environmental law, the National Environmental Policy Act. There's still time for you to share your thoughts. You can, as always, tweet us at Central Time WPR or head over to the Ideas Network Facebook page and let us know what you think. Thank you. In the early days of the coronavirus pandemic, tests for COVID-19 were in very short supply. Wisconsin has built up its testing capacity since then, but experts say it's still not enough to get the pandemic under control. Bram Sable-Smith looks at where we are with our testing here in the state and where we may be heading.
UW epidemiologist Ajay Sethi says there's a straightforward reason to get a COVID-19 test.
The only way you will know whether or not that you have COVID is to get a test.
Sethi says in public health, testing is what's known as a secondary prevention strategy, meaning something that lets you detect a problem early. The gold standard in public health is primary prevention, or stopping something before it can happen. And Sethi says testing can be used to help do that, too.
If we could test everybody in a community in a week, single day, then we could see who has a disease, who doesn't, and appropriately isolate those people who have disease.
But of course, we can't test everyone in Wisconsin all at once. The state's current daily capacity for tests is about 24,000. And the number of tests actually reported each day is about half of that, meaning too few people are showing up. Even Wisconsin's single-day record of over 16,000 tests is well below the number needed to keep the outbreak from growing. A Harvard analysis from the end of June said that would take 19,000 tests a day, and 70,000 daily tests are needed to actually suppress the outbreak. Chuck Wierzeka of the Wisconsin Health Department says that while having a target number of tests is helpful,
the number itself is really a surrogate for the right testing that we're trying to achieve.
Essentially, Wierzeka says it's not the number of tests exactly, it's how you use them. That means testing people with symptoms in their close contacts, but also paying special attention to high-risk populations and communities with active outbreaks. That includes testing asymptomatic people at nursing homes, where DHS has investigated 151 outbreaks. And Wierzeka says the state is still focused on increasing its daily testing capacity. But
we're always watching the national supply chain because it's still kind of teetering on the edge of running out of different important materials.
Important materials like the swabs that go in your nose and the chemicals needed to even run the tests. In other states like California, Georgia, and Florida, supply shortages have forced officials to turn some test seekers away or even shutter some testing sites. Ezekiel Emanuel of the University of Pennsylvania says the federal government would typically help shore up that supply chain. But that hasn't happened, as President Trump's administration has played a largely hands-off role in responding to the pandemic.
We should have been spending the last 4 months beefing up the supply chain, making sure we had enough machines, inducing the large test companies to actually put in the capacity and make the capital investment.
Instead, individual states like Wisconsin are on their own to procure the supplies and also to develop their own testing strategies. Emanuel says that's not typical.
In another moment, not a Trump administration moment, you would have had good guidance from the federal government about things like who to test, what sequence.
Wierzeka says Wisconsin is getting some guidance on testing from the federal government, but they're also collaborating with other state and local health agencies. This virus is new and novel for all of them.
We're learning probably as much from other states and from our local health departments as we are from at the federal level, and we're doing our best to share up the learning that we're doing as well.
And Wierzeka says testing alone won't stop the outbreak.
If people are opening up too quickly, and people aren't wearing masks when they're in public, and they're spending too much time in congregate settings, it really isn't going to be enough testing to help you stop the outbreak.
That means people's behavior matters too. Bram Sable-Smith, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Coming up tomorrow afternoon here on Central Time, the United States is seeing a nationwide protest movement in the midst of a major crisis. It's not the first time this has happened. Our guests share some lessons from the past for what's going on in today's historic moment and the kind of things, policy, and social changes that might come out of it. Also, Wisconsin farmers can use a new hotline for help with mental and emotional health concerns. We'll get a look at how it works and who can use it. We'll kick off a series of candidate interviews in the primary elections for Wisconsin's congressional seats. We'll be doing a series of those here on Central Time and on The Morning Show. And we'll check in on a story of some federal law enforcement officers being used in Portland, Oregon, dealing with protests and some surprising arrests they've made along the way. That and more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. weekdays from 6 to 9 a.m. It's the morning show with Kate Archer Kent. Tomorrow at 8, it's a big election year in the United States, but a lot of people won't vote. Kate and her guests look at the latest research on non-voting in American elections. That's coming up tomorrow at 8 on The Morning Show. Coming up next, it's news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. And then kids are seeing a lot of news about political conflict lately. A psychologist joins the show to talk about the impact that can have on children and to share some advice for parents on talking to kids and teens about the world of politics. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.